Thank you very much to all of you for the invitation. I really hope that this the fact that I'm giving a talk doesn't preclude me from being invited physically to Perimeter, because I've never been there, and I really look forward to visit you when possible. So the work that I'm going to talk to you today is in collaboration with Brando, Juan, Ricardo, and Mark, and parts also with Francesco Sgarlat and Javi Serra. You will see their references when time goes by. Oops, sorry. So basically, the question I want to talk about orbits around effective field theories. And I don't need to introduce this to you guys, but basically, effective field theories are just a useful tool when you work at the boundary between what we know and what we don't know or we cannot calculate. For instance, part of my motivation is the fact that in the standard model, we like to parameterize physics beyond the standard model using effective field theories. But similarly, also in quantum gravity, you capture the effects of quantum gravity exactly by and gravity by an effective field theories. But similarly, in the context of the chiral Lagrangian, you know that you can actually capture physics that typically is dominated by strong coupling in a certain regime using effective field theories. So they're really a versatile tool. And one reason why we like them so much is that they really are model independent, in the sense that they are very good in parameterizing our ignorance, in the sense that they capture the broadest possible hypothesis in terms of the physics that we don't know, right? So the point is that within the effective field theory, there are many different things that can happen. For instance, look at this. By the way, do you see things moving, right? I mean, things appear, okay. It happened, I gave a talk and after 5 minutes, nothing was happening. So it was very embarrassing. So this is the 2-2-2 scattering amplitude at three level, very simple function analytic in the Mandelstam variables S and T. So you can really expand it in this way. And as you know, within an effective field theory, everything goes. So you can have different patterns of sizes of the coefficients multiplying the different powers of S and T. And the question that I would like to address in this talk is which of these patterns that I just illustrated here are compatible with a special class of UV completions, which are characterized by being causal and unitary. Okay, so I would like some effective field theories that come from my microscopic unitary theories. And I would like to understand what is their behavior in terms of energy. Oops. So let me just help you getting familiarized with the notation. In particular, these C's, which are in the 2-2-2 amplitude, the coefficients of S and T, I portray them in this kind of table. I hope that by memorizing these now, you are able to follow a little bit better the talk. Okay, it's just to see, this will come over and over. So at the beginning of the talk, I will mention to you a few things about the infrared that perhaps you have not thought about. You will see later why you have not thought about it, because they're ruled out, but anyway. And then I will introduce a tool which allows me to relate these infrared theories to some features in the UV. Many of you have know this tool or have heard of it. These are dispersion relations, but I will try to give it a slightly new perspective by introducing two concepts, that of arcs, which prepare a particular form of these dispersion relations. And then I will talk to you about moments you might know already, heard of them, but in this context, they offer a very nice perspective on these relations. I will show you that when you consider a theory in the three-level limit, whatever that means, will be clear later, but when you can ignore loops, basically, I will show you that there are some bounds that basically exclude or at least bound very tightly a lot of these coefficients here. However, I will then spend a moment to discuss loop effects. These are not very often discussed in this context of dispersion relations, etc. And I will show you that many of the bounds that one naively obtains at tree level are modified. Okay, so this is roughly the outline. Let's start from an infrared point of view. So this plot just portrays, illustrates the energy and the 2-2-2 scattering amplitude. Keep in mind that this will be the only thing we will be looking at today, just 2-2-2 scattering, very simple. So the amplitude is, as long as we are agnostic about the UV in an effective theory, it's just a generic function of energy here. And I show this down here. But when you let this run, so when you vary the energy, this is a quantum field theory, and the coefficients, they also run. Okay, the bars here have changed in case you have not perceived the minuscule changes. So one question that one can ask is, can this coefficient be hierarchical? In a sense, is it possible to have the first few coefficients big and then, ploof, the next ones very small? And you quickly realize that this is not possible because the running in within your effective theory tends to homogenize coefficients. This goes under the name of naturalness somehow. So basically, when you discuss effective field theories, typically people tend to take coefficients that are comparable among them, just because running mixes them. However, there are other patterns that behave differently. For instance, a pattern like this, in which only coefficients of higher powers of energy are large, and the leading ones, the more relevant operators, are small. This is unaltered by the running. And the reason is very simple, is that there are some approximate symmetries that protect this kind of patterns. So they make it natural. You're very familiar with the case of a Goldstone boson, in which the shift symmetry, pi going to pi plus alpha, implies that the Lagrangian comes with some derivatives. Okay, and hence the amplitude comes with powers of energy, one for each derivative. In this theory, you can have C0 and C1 equal zero and just start your theory at C2. Similarly, the Galileans that you might have heard of, they have a more structured shift symmetry. The Lagrangian comes with at least two derivatives, and the amplitude grows like 8 powers of the energy. There is also some terms that grows like 6 power of the energy, but just for illustration, I've not included it here. And in the same way, you can generalize this idea to what I would call super soft. These are theories in which there is so much shift symmetry, so by a constant, but also a generic function of x, that the amplitude naturally starts with many powers of the energy. Okay, so keep in mind that this is a natural possibility for what concerns the effective field theory. Okay, we will come back to this a bit later, but just this was just to illustrate you what the landscape of infrared effective field theories can look like. Okay, there can really be any growth in energy that you want. Everything is natural. So the question that I will address in the following is whether these super soft theories like this one can be UV completed in quantum field theory. This is one question. There will be many addressed, but this is one recurring theme. So to address this, I will discuss this relation between the infrared and the UV. And in particular, I will start by just looking at the forward amplitude, so with t equals zero, where the amplitude is just a function of Mandelstam S, total energy. And in particular, I want to translate the physical properties of causality and unitarity of the 2-2-2 scattering amplitude into some mathematical entities, mathematical properties. And in particular, causality is known to be related with the amplitude being analytic in the complex S-plane. So I will discuss now things in the complex S-plane. And in the complex S plane, the amplitude is analytic up to some non-analyticities, which are located in places where the amplitude has some is physical. So, For instance, for the 2-2-2 amplitude, this is for positive S above threshold. So here along the real line S above 4m squared, this is non-analytic here. And because of crossing symmetry, a similar non-analyticity is also located for negative S. This corresponds to the U channel. There is a pole also on the origin because the object that I'm actually interested in is the amplitude divided by some powers of S, okay? So basically in this complex plane, you can visualize two regions. One, which is where we can think of an effective field theory being a good description of things. And another one, the blue region here, where instead we call this a UV, where we want to be agnostic about what is there, okay? So this idea of dispersion relation starts by considering this contour integral that happened to vanish for sufficiently powers of S here, S bigger than 2, because of what is called the Froissart bound. This is something that holds in any massive gapped quantum field theory. And because of this idea of analyticity and the Cauchy theorem, this G0 can be deformed into this other contour, which actually enters within the effective field theory regime, okay? Now the other—
Sorry, Francesco, just to be sure, are you going to be describing gapped theories or gapless?
Mainly gap theories. I mean, you can think of these, but typically the interesting regime is where the energy S that I will be thinking of is much bigger than the mass. So there is still the gap is only to make the assumption of the Froissart bound more rigorous. Otherwise, you can just say that I'm discussing any theory assuming that the integral at infinity goes to zero.
Okay.
Make sense? Or so either—
Yeah, I'm just wondering what is the expansion of this red cross, if it's at 2m square or if should I think of zero?
Ah, good, good. Yeah, then in that case, if you want to be precise, is a 2m square, yes. Sorry for that. Sorry, this was a bit Pictionary-like style. So I didn't, you won't see the mass until the end. In the end, it becomes super important. But for the first part, is not so important because of this. But yeah, thanks for pointing this out. Okay, so the other physical property, unitarity, is translated via the optical theorem with the fact that the imaginary part of the amplitude is proportional to the cross-section. So this thing is positive, the integral along this line. So in summary, this integral here is equal to this integral here. We introduced this tool, the arcs, which by the way, they are very useful in many contexts, also in the context of the S-matrix booster. That I will mention this again later, but yeah, just to advertise a little bit the versatility of this tool. It's just a contour integral here with some radius that I call S-bar. Of the amplitude divided by some power of S. And this is equal to this integral defined in the UV with this thing being positive. So of course you see immediately that arcs are a positive object. Now, the point is that the arcs here as defined on the left-hand side are calculable within the effective field theory. And in order to help you follow what I'm talking about, at three level, these arcs are just like the Wilson coefficients that I mentioned before, okay? These ones that appear in the table. But I'll be more specific about this in a moment. So the point is that you can import this conclusion that you made in the UV, that arcs are positive, into the infrared and use it as the consistency condition for your effective field theory. This is already well known. I'm sure that many of you already heard about this. It appeared in this article 15 years ago by Adams, Arcaniami, and Dubowski, Nicolis, and Ratazzi. And it's all very nice, but I would like to understand if there is more than this. And in fact, if you look at this integral, it's not just positive. You make a simple change of variables, and you put this integral in this form. And this form is something that as physicists, although perhaps we don't remember it, we know very well. These are called moments. And moments are everywhere, right? electric dipole moment, moment of inertia, et cetera, et cetera. These are all things that we are very familiar with. And they're called moments just because they can be written as an integral of this kind. For instance, think about a stone, asteroid, neutron star, whatever your favorite three-dimensional object is. And think about d mu being the mass distribution, something positive, okay? Then the moment for n equals zero, the zeroth moment, is just the total mass, okay? Integral over mass. And this is something that sets the units of our problem. The first moment, what is it? Okay, integral over x, d mu x. This is just the center of mass, okay? And the center of mass, we know that if you take a stone, it cannot be bigger than the radius of the mass distribution, right? So it's always at most at r times m. And instead, for x squared, the second moment is the moment of inertia and is maximized when all the mass is in a ring, okay? It's located in a ring. And in this situation, it's at most r squared times m. So you see immediately that these three bounds, sorry, these three values, these three moments are actually related to two quantities, R and M. So they're not completely arbitrary. And in fact, there are many bounds that moments satisfy in general. So let me show you what all these bounds are. Now I gave you an intuitive picture for the fact that moments satisfy bounds, but let me go through it more formally. So I'm interested in bounds on these arcs or Wilson coefficients, and I show you that these are related to bounds on moments. Now, sorry, I've always this problem with Zoom that I have plenty of windows that obscure my view of things, and I don't see my slides anymore. Anyway, I will show you now that there is a one-to-one correspondence between bounds on moments and positive polynomials in the unity from 0 to 1. In fact, take a polynomial which is positive, okay? Just by fact, I give you a polynomial, generic, but positive between 0 and 1, so such that the alpha make it positive. We can shovel this into the measure integral, right? And this will still be positive. Integral between 0, 1, positive measure, positive polynomial, something positive. This gives me, a relation between the arcs, because arcs are just equal to these moments, according to the previous slide, okay? So any positive polynomial gives me a relation between arcs. So for the first three arcs, let me give you a few examples. From an effective theory point of view, this could take any values, right? Wherever this is gray, even here and here. Sorry for the plot. So I take some polynomials, 1, x, and x squared. These are definitely positive between 0 and 1. And they imply that the arcs are positive, as we saw before. So now in this plot, which is just the second arc in units of the zeroth arc and the first arc in unit of the zeroth arc, now only the positive region is allowed. Now I take other polynomials, 1 minus x and x times 1 minus x. It gives me these two relations between the arcs that carve out a little bit more the allowed region. I take another polynomial, which is this one, and this carves out even more the space of allowed polynomials. And in fact, it turns out that all the positive polynomials, you can write them like this, x to the n, 1 minus x to the k. These are called Bernstein polynomials, by the way. And when you take n and k to infinity, you realize that basically these segments, they converge to this smooth line, okay? Fantastic. So we have found a way of actually capturing all the bounds implied by moments. This is all there is. There is a theorem, by the way, by Hausdorff that tells you that this is all there is. There are no more bounds. There is a unique solution that basically tells you that there is nothing more than this. However, when we talk about effective field theories, often we are dealing only with a small subset of coefficients, right? I mean, the whole point of the effective field theory is that you have an expansion that is truncated at some point. So it is a bit annoying that here, in order to find a bound on three coefficients, a2, a0, and a1, we needed infinitely many polynomials, infinitely many conditions, right? It would be better to have a finite number of bounds for a finite number of arcs. Okay. It turns out that I'm sure you have already thought of this, but it is just related to polynomials of finite order. So if I can classify all the positive polynomials up to a given order, then I've solved this problem of finding all the bounds involving only arcs up to a certain degree, Wilson coefficients up to a certain degree. And it turns out that these polynomials can be written in this form as a generic polynomial squared plus x times a generic polynomial squared, and so on. Just these four classes. These four polynomials will give me optimal bounds involving only a certain number of arcs. Take the first one. So I put it again into my measure. Q1 is just a generic polynomial, not necessarily positive. Now, in the what I was doing before, the alpha were special. They were giving me a positive polynomials. Here, since I already have a square here, the alpha can be arbitrary, okay? When I put it, this thing, I integrate it, it gives me a condition that the sum of the arcs I plus j times this coefficient must be positive. And this is equivalent to saying that the matrix AI plus j must be positive definite. For n equal core, 4, this corresponds to this matrix here being positive. Matrices of this type are called Hankel matrices because they are symmetric in the indices and they just have entries which are like this I plus j, okay? Good. We can repeat this for the other three classes of polynomials, and we find four types of constraints related to Hankel matrices being positive. Here the numbers imply n just tells you what is the maximum size of your matrix, so the maximum arc or Wilson coefficient that you would like to constrain. Well, 0, it tells you what is the first one. So in this case, it includes 0. This one starts with 1. And these are differences of the different Hankel matrices. So in practice, by the way, this is any energy within the effective field theory here, any S. So up to 3 arcs, indeed, when I make these conditions more explicit, I find 3 relation, which is exactly what I wanted. A limited number of relation for an limited number of arcs. And they give me this banana. Now this relation here is non-linear, so you get this beautiful curve. And if you include up to 4 arcs, you get this kind of three-dimensional banana or wing or whatever, okay? Good. So this is what I refer to as optimal constraint. Optimal in the sense that if you take the volume of all possible constraint and project it onto the first 3, this is what you would get, okay? There is nothing more than this. By adding conditions and adding arcs or Wilson coefficients, you're not changing anything, okay? When you project it down, it always goes back to this banana. Okay, so, now I will interrupt a little bit this kind of theoretical rhetoric and try to wake you up a little bit with some applications of this of these things, more phenomenological implications. So the first one is about this idea of super softness that I mentioned briefly at the beginning. Let me reiterate on what this is. The question is whether this
cutting. Before you start this new topic, can I ask something, Francesco? So. Right now, because of subtractions, am I right that you are insensitive to the first Wilson coefficients?
Exactly, you're totally right. In fact, it will be clear in a second with the 3 level, because now it's just arcs, but I can already show you this. But yeah, basically, these arcs are related to the coefficients plus 2. So as you said, because of the 2 subtractions, C0, which is basically lambda and lambda phi to the 4, is inaccessible. Yeah. The first coefficient you're starting.
Can you comment a little bit on that? Do you think that's a bug or a feature, or what's the physics of missing that term? And how could you imagine improving the formalism to know about C0?
Yeah.
I mean, we thought a little bit about it and we could not. So it's really an honest question. Yeah.
I mean, I think, my point of view is that you cannot say anything on it in the sense that Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, in the end, this is about making certain assumptions, relating certain assumptions about the UV to the IR, right? I'm sure, I mean, there are certainly some assumptions you can do about the UV to get something on C0. The question is whether you're earning anything in the sense that if I make an assumption about the convergence of my theory in infinity, and then I get an information on C0, I might as well make an assumption on C0 directly. It talks more to me than a assumption on something I don't know. I don't know if I was clear on these. Or
So in the original bounds that people in the beginning of S-matrix bootstrap, like Martin and others, were trying to put on theories, the first quantity they were considering was precisely C0, right? They were putting bounds or related to C0 on the effective quartic coupling of pi, say.
Yeah, you mean
the analog of lambda phi to the 4, right? So just from I forgot the name of the bound, Martin's bound, the growth, Frassat bound. Just from Frassat bound, they could find some bound on C0. I think those bounds, if they are more in spirit what we are doing right now, they use very strongly that the probability is smaller than 1, and not only that it's positive, right?
Okay.
And
yeah.
That was crucial to get some control over C0. But
I see.
I was wondering if we have some argument about why in ineffective field theories or in this kind of approach that uses more positivity of moments, whether it's a feature or a bug that we cannot bound C0, and whether there is some physics in it or if it's a technical thing that limits subtractions.
No, in fact, the moment is just a technical thing. No, you're right that if you have, you're basically saying that perhaps if you keep all the information about UV positivity, you can keep this into your as an output. No, it's something interesting to think about. I have some comments for this later. Perhaps we can.
Okay.
So the question is, the amplitude can grow as s to the n in some regime. This is this idea of super softness. So just to illustrate it more phenomenologically, we have plenty of examples in which the amplitude does whatever it wants to do, right? In Baba scattering, so electron positron to mu muon, the amplitude just decreases with energy. In lambda phi to the 4 or Higgs scattering, if anything like that would ever exist, the amplitude is rather flat. It's just lambda, right? And instead, in Fermi theory, we know that the amplitude grows linearly with S, with energy squared, right? So the question is whether another amplitude like this would ever be possible. And as I just flashed before, in the three-level approximation, so ignoring any loops, the amplitude is just, in the forward limit, a polynomial in S squared. And now you can compute these arcs, and they are just given by, as I already advertised, the Wilson coefficients. But there is a slight mismatch between the order of the arcs and the order of the Wilson coefficient, just as Pedro pointed out, because the Frassat bound doesn't give you access to this C0 and only starts giving you, can be used from S squared. So basically the question is whether it's possible to have this, that to have a regime in which this theory dominates over the just S squared. So to understand this, we look back at these plots, but now instead of arcs, I can put directly the Wilson coefficient. So this is C4 over C2, and this is C6 in units of C2. And basically the fact that this plot doesn't extend beyond here, and it doesn't extend beyond here, implies that C2 S squared is bigger than C4 S squared, and so on. So all this series is monotonically decreasing in the coefficients. So in other words, the effective field theory only works up to the positions in which C2S square dominates. When it stops dominate, these bounds tell you, nah, stop. The answers you're making is wrong. Everything is going wrong. And basically this implies that the answers you're using is wrong. So the effective field theory stops to be valid, okay? And this is because, our arcs knew about the energy scale at which they were measured. Remember that it was an arc that could be taken at some radius S. And S is now the physical energy that enters here and leads to this argument. So basically, the bounds I just show you, they have information about the ultimate cutoff of the theory. And it tells you that these super soft theories, the cutoff is so low that super softness will never be observable. You will never do an experiment and find that the amplitude grows like S to the N, because every experiment will just show this type of behavior. So in the table I showed you before, basically now I've been discussing the first column, and I showed you that these are monotonically decreasing and leading to this banana picture, or more generally just a monotonically decreasing series. And in particular, Good. Another application that I like very much is this of higher spin, massive higher spin. I mean, you have heard many times of higher spin resonances because they exist. They exist in QCD, nuclei, atoms. They exist in string theory, whether it exists or not. But there's one common feature of all these cases, and it's the fact that the mass of these higher spin resonances is bigger than their inverse size. As illustration, this is a plot of the resonances in QCD from a lattice QCD simulation. And you see that the resonances of spin higher than 2 are always above lambda QCD, which is the inverse scale, inverse radius of this type of resonances, okay? So my question is whether this is a generic feature or just an accident of the examples that we've been looking at. Can there be lighter, higher spin states? Let's look at the amplitude for 2-to-2 scatterings of higher spin particles, okay? The interaction of higher spin particles, they grow with energy. And they grow with energy. And in particular, how much in energy can we go to collide two higher spin particles? Well, we can localize them as much as their inverse size. So this is the maximum energy at which we can scatter higher spin particles. We can compute the amplitude, and it's easy to see that the amplitude is given by this form in powers of S suppressed by the mass of the higher spin particles. So in the language of
In this plot, there is mesons and glue balls, everything, right?
Everything, yes, exactly.
Okay, there is no spin to glue ball below lambda QCD?
No.
I see. Hmm. Okay.
And basically, you'll see that these guys, you can just identify them with C2 and C2J, where J is the spin of the particles. Yeah, by the way, Peter, these arguments strictly like these, they are for J bigger than 2. But 2 is the edge where this thing holds exactly as I'm telling you, okay?
Yeah, I remember in Wikipedia, there was a spin to Google about that. Spin to Wikipedia.
Check later online. Okay, anyway, this C2 is, this guy is C2, and this guy is C2J, where J is the spin of the particle, roughly. And the relation I told you before was that C2 was bigger. They were monotonically decreasing in units of S. And S is now given at most by this energy, given their inverse size. So when you plug this in, use our bound, you find that the mass is bigger than the size of these higher spin resonances. So higher spin resonances are always heavier than their inverse size. The nature of QFT is not just an accident of the examples that we have in front of us. Okay, so let me go back to this idea of super softness. In particular, there is, well, not really to this idea, but to another interesting phenomenological application, which is, sorry, I cannot see what's behind here. Yeah, basically, you might have heard of this Galilean theories. These are, it's a theory where the amplitude just starts with this term, S squared T. So far we could not say anything about the Galilean because we were looking at the forward amplitude at t equals zero, okay? But this is a theory which is very interesting from a phenomenological point of view, and in particular in the context of cosmology. So let me show you a little bit how you can build bounds that also involve this guy, okay? Well, I'll stick to the three levels so that it's easier to explain to you, and the loops will be discussed later. So with these ansatz here, I can build some arcs which now depend on T by just looking at making the same construction as before, and I take the amplitude at S with finite T, and here below I have a slightly different denominator which also involves T. So in the three level at low energy, you find that given this definition of arcs, these coefficients are just the T derivatives of this object, okay? So it's the same as before, but then we take T derivatives, okay? Good, it turns out that when this T derivative acts on the imaginary part, you can expand the imaginary part in partial waves. You get Legendre polynomials or whatever you want to call them. And basically you get a sum, an infinite sum. If you do this explicitly, there is a power of L, where L is really the partial wave, to some power, to Q, where Q is the how many derivatives you took, times something positive, the imaginary part of the partial waves. And this was realized already, I mean, was realized by Nima and collaborators, that there is more information here than just than what we looked at so far. And in particular, in the language that I've been using, you can now see that we have something which looks like a moment in L, right? It's powers of L over an integral, a positive measure. Okay, there is a discrete sum. This is a detail that we can discuss together later. But basically, we are in the presence of a two-dimensional moment problem, because now we have the integral in S and the sum in L. And it's very similar to what we were saying before. It's now finding the most positive two-dimensional polynomial. Okay, and in particular, when you go through the same machinery that I spare, for the time being, you get bounds that now go in all directions. They don't just go vertically, but they also go here horizontally. Okay, so they relate also terms with different derivatives of T. And in particular, you find that the C2, 1, so the coefficient associated with these Galileans, is not positive, but is bigger than a slightly negative quantity. So it is controlled by C2. C2, I remind you, is just the coefficient of S squared. So it can be negative, but not much. And in addition, as was pointed out by one of your connationals, Simon Caron-Huot, well, sorry, I don't know what nationality you are, but I meant Canadian. Basically, you can use additionally the idea that the amplitude is crossing symmetric, and you can find a nice relation. There are bounds that go this way, bounds that go this way, blah, blah, blah. And eventually you find that this Galilean coefficient is also smaller than another quantity, okay? So it's sandwiched between two values. These Galileans, in other words, it's tightly bounded. So all this theory of cosmology now really are facing an important constraint, because this cannot be arbitrary, but there is a two-side bound. I will show you in a moment what happens when you actually take into account loop effects in this context. But for the time being, just be happy with this being two-sided bounds. So the picture so far is that when we look at the amplitude at three level, this is an expansion in S and in T, and polynomial, analytic, because it's a three level. There are infinitely many coefficients a priori, because it's an effective field theory, but only three of them can lead the amplitude. In particular, as Pedro mentioned, C0 is arbitrary from this point of view. C2 is positive. C21, coefficient of S squared T, is sandwiched. And all the other guys are so sandwiched that they are never observable. Okay. So this is.
Can I ask one more thing? So C0, as you say, it's arbitrary.
Yeah.
But here, my feeling is that right now we are considering a massless theory. Is it true, or are we doing still massive?
I mean, this can be defined in the massive case. It's not clear from this expression, but this would be S minus 2M. So it would be powers of S minus 2M in this case. So in the massive theory, you can define a C2 and it would respect all these bounds. It would hold in the massless case under the assumption that still the integral at infinity zero.
What I was a bit concerned with the massive theory is the following. So in the same way that you missed C0 because of subtractions,
yes.
Suppose that between 0 and 4m squared, you add bound states. So you add poles, right? As many as you might want, right? So you have a theory that has some stable, other stable particles, right?
Okay, good. You're thinking now about the cubic interaction, like...
For example, and you would also miss it, right?
Good. Yeah.
Whatever bounds, they must hold for any C0 and for any spectrum of bound states. It looks so general that it looks hard to believe that they could be restrictive. So that was my confusion, right? Because you can put like a theory of 20 bound states, right? So I have C0, then I have 20 cubic couplings, and then I have C2, C3, and so on. And your bounds for C2, C3, and so on would not care if I have 0 bound states or if I have 20 bound states, right?
So the contribution from bound state happens to cancel in these arcs.
Right, for the same reason that C0 drops, right? So
yeah.
So isn't it a bit funny that you would get bounds on effective field theory for theories that, and the bounds would be the same if I have a theory which has no bound states or if I have a theory that has 20 bound states?
Yeah, you're saying that this is a hint that there must be something more than... in between what I'm saying and optimal bounds. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes.
I mean, from my limited point of view, it's not perhaps so weird in the sense that these bounds are allowing, since they are insensitive to these other particles, they are, I mean, you know, they are allowing for anything. So they're kind of allowing too much. You're saying it's possible that you can develop some tools like your S-matrix bootstrap in which you're more sensitive to these infrared poles and you will be able to subtract them and obtain better bounds on C2 and so on. Is that where you're going, perhaps?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think, yeah. So because of these subtractions, you drop everything that doesn't grow with energy, right?
Exactly.
So C0 doesn't grow, so you drop it. The lambda over the pole even decays, so it's even better. You drop it. Yeah, I just wonder if we are missing a conceptual idea with these arcs that we need to have an integrand that although we do want to drop the arc at infinity, we don't want to be insensitive completely to C0 and lambda. What I would love is to have a better kernel rather than just these rational function kernels that you are using. And those kernels would not kill the cubic couplings and the C0.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if that's physically unreasonable to expect or if it's mathematically unreasonable to expect.
Well, the kernels that I'm using, basically, they're these polynomials and they are the most general positive ones, right? So your point of view would be perhaps you can use something using a kernel that basically is not necessarily positive might have also a discontinuity.
Or that is positive, but has a discontinuity. Like instead of 1 over s to the n, like 1 over s to the n times square root of s minus 4m square.
Yeah.
Something that also has a cut. So you can still draw an arc, you can still blow the contour and you would still drop infinity. But because of an essential singularity at infinity, you would now start to be able to probe C0 and C1. But I don't know if it would contradict your physical intuition, but this is very much a particularity of massive theories. Of course, if you are gapless, then you don't have bound states. And so then you don't have these questions. But on the other hand, then, as you know well, better than me, you have all these issues of the logs and it's harder to disentangle things.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, I would prefer to have to discuss in a gap theory because we have a gap and the arcs are very well defined and we don't mix stuff.
I don't mind the logs.
I'm confused about, I can throw in a gazillion bound states and everything is insensitive to them. It sounds unphysical.
Yeah. I mean, you can, if you want, the context in which I'm working is the one in which you have perhaps an accidental symmetry for which this bound state or these poles below threshold are just not there. But no, I agree that the question more generally, it's interesting. I mean, it seems to point towards the message that there is something more between these bounds and some ideal bounds that you can derive from with a different tool, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. So actually, the question of Pedro hooks very well into what I'm going to discuss now, which is going beyond tree level. So it's really about these logs that he mentioned a second ago, okay? And for simplicity, I will talk only about Goldstone bosons in the sense that basically I will take this C0 equal to 0, or lambda phi to the 4 with lambda equal to 0, okay? So loops are a bit easier to classify, but I mean, we're doing this also for the case of a non-zero C0, okay? Good, so this is about these locks that Pedro mentioned. And why are these important? Well, they're important because before at tree level, Wilson coefficients and arcs were in one-to-one correspondence, okay? However, infrared effects change this. And in particular, the bounds apply on arcs, and therefore, the bounds will remain the same for arcs, as I showed you now. Now, the bounds on Wilson coefficient will be different. So these infrared effects can be classified into two classes. I think it's good to keep this in mind. One effect is due to running. So very easily, if you have a diagram like this, this will introduce you have two insertions of C2. So this really, when you compute it, it gives you C2 as to the 4, and there is a log, okay? Log of S over mu. Mu is the scale at which you fix the 2 to 2 amplitude. So it's really a running effect, okay? And there is another class of effects. I mean, same diagram, but turned 90 degrees. And this gives you effects that go like S square T square log of S over T. The reason why these two are different, although the diagram is the same, is the fact that arcs are not crossing symmetric. I will go back to this in a moment, but it's the fact that the arc is taken at small t because we're expanding in powers of t, but the integral over S, remember, extends over infinity. So these effects, they contribute to the arc n with terms that are inversely proportional to the energy, okay? So, and these become more and more relevant, more and more important as I increase the number of the order of arc, this n. So basically it's telling me that all arcs below a certain order, all Wilson their relation with the Wilson coefficient will be compromised. And in particular, all bounds that I showed you that imply guys down here, they will be modified. Similarly, collinear divergences, they will modify the t derivative of arcs, okay, by effects that are of order s over m squared. This is exactly what Pedro was referring to. In the massless theory, you have logs that compromise everything, okay? And in particular, these effects are only important for coefficients that have at least two powers of t, okay? Good, so let me just be more specific. First, the running effect. Now the ansatz for the amplitude is a bit more complicated. In fact, my coefficients now depend on energy, okay? Instead of having just C4, I have a C4 of S, is the running, okay? And you might ask, okay, can I apply the three-level bounds just to the running coefficient? For illustration, it is simpler to change coordinates. Instead of using this banana, which had these coordinates here, I will use a slightly different combination. The x-axis remains the same, but the y-axis has this different combination. So the allowed region at tree level is not this gray one, but it's this thing here. arcs are the suitable object to study this infrared effect, because indeed, in the by changing the radius of the arc, I'm really tracking the theory at different energies. Okay, and indeed, I can write the arcs in the theory with loop effects, and it turns out that the first arc is just C2. C2 doesn't run because I'm in the theory of a Goldstone boson. The first arc indeed is the running coefficient C4, okay? And it's equivalent to the arc, so it's fantastic. It looks like bounds are the same for the running coefficient as they were at tree level. But then when I look at the second arc, it's not just the sixth running coefficient, but there is a loop effects that appears in front. So in fact, when I look at the allowed region for my coefficients now, instead of just being this dashed line here as a tree level, now it extends in below here. And in particular, the colors here are just to help you understanding how good your effective field theory is, in the sense that if you are in the blue region, any point in the blue region is very close to the cutoff. This is because here there is a S, the energy. So when I increase the energy, poof, these points would hit the bound, okay? They would, while instead in the red region, we have theories which can have very large separation of scales, so that they are, you evaluated at some energy and you can run much higher, to much higher values in energy. So the important thing is that now there is this region that opens here. So as I mentioned before, all bounds that involve C6 that before was assumed to be always positive, this determinant here was supposed to be bigger than one. This ratio here was bigger than one, and C6 was supposed to be positive. Now this no longer holds, okay? So these bounds here are red because they are not valid anymore. Particular also, this upper bound here becomes a little bit stronger, but just by a little bit. Instead, these bounds here are now modified. So this is just to mention how important infrared effects are. There is a whole region that opens up that if I don't understand infrared effects, I'm ignoring. I'm putting too strong bounds on my theory. Just a small illustrative sketch on what happens when I run up and down with energy. So in particular, when I go down in energy, it turns out that theories that were up here, they go down actually in this region that was outside of the naive three-level bounds. However, it's interesting to run up in energy. And what happens is that there are two classes of theories. There are some theories that eventually go in a regime in which three-level is okay. And there are other theories instead, which never make it. They go out by never being three-level, okay? So it would be interesting for me to understand a bit more these theories that never behave like a three-level theory. Okay, so the last chapter in this talk, it would be about the other type of infrared divergences, which are related to these collinear effects that I mentioned before. Why you have this is because we have a large separation of scales.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
So in the talks before, you were doing one loop corrections?
Yes, yes.
Modified at higher and higher loops?
Mm-hmm.
Or?
Yeah, this is so this piece is a one loop correction. And this piece involves also the two loop correction.
Okay.
The fact that I was I was assuming the theory of a Goldstone boson implies that things are much simpler, because at order S4, you have only one loop. At order S6, you have up to two loops and so on. So the, things are easier to organize. Is that okay, answer?
Yes, thank you.
So sorry, I have these animations that we have to go through. Okay, so as I say, there is now a large separation of scale. And where does it come from? It comes from the fact that I want energy to be bigger than the mass. This is because I'm interested in effective field theories in the regime in which they are interesting. So I want to do the scattering of particles at energies above their mass, right? Much above, okay? And on the other hand, the region of T is limited by the fact that my whole discussion orbited around the amplitude being analytic. And this is true only for T smaller than the mass. So you see that now we have a hierarchy between S and T. We don't have crossing symmetry as assumed in some of the bounds I mentioned before. In particular, the amplitude now includes, in addition to running, also these logs here. So these are powers of S squared, T squared, and these logs here. And we can look at it in this table. And you see that this has two powers of T. So basically, or more, sorry, I forgot to say that, yeah, there are more of these, as Davide asked, that they can be higher loops that come with more powers of S squared and T squared. But anyway, they start at T squared. So anything that has more than two powers of square will be affected by these bounds. And in particular, let me go back to this bound on the Galilean that I mentioned before. Remember, I told you that the Galilean was tightly constrained because there was a bound from below and there was a bound from above from assuming crossing symmetry of the amplitude, okay? This is this work by Simon, Caron-Huot, and Van Duong, but also by Tolly, Wang, and Zhu. Sorry, it's not in 2029. It's almost contemporary to the one by Simon. Anyway, so they found this upper bound, but this log of S over N implies that basically as the mass goes to zero, the bound evaporates completely. This is in the lines of what Pedro was hinting to before. So in the massless theory, some of the bounds really disappear, and this is one of them, okay? Admittedly, when the mass is different from zero, the effects are not very big because you have a 16 pi square here. I mean, the thing is actually pretty small. Good, so this brings me to the end. Particularly, I assumed unitarity in, well, first of all, I divided the universe in two regions in which we have the UV, where we don't know or we cannot compute, and the IR, where we can use effective field theories. And I showed you the unitarity through this idea of moments, and using only positivity gave me some analytic constraints on effective field theories. In particular, I show you that there can be at three level only a small number of coefficients that can dominate the amplitude. There's no idea of super softness. Higher spin are bound by their inverse size. And I showed you that the infrared running can be important, in particular, many of these bounds, they just don't hold anymore. And I was thinking along the line of some of you guys that this S-metric bootstrap idea really, via some numerical tool, doesn't just use positivity, but uses the full unitarity, and was also used in recently to say things about effective field theories. So for me, it would be nice to understand a little bit more these analytics and numerics, how the interplay is, and also the fact that so the S-metric bootstrap is used also to really understand the, not really in the context of effective field theories, but more generally to understand theories at a scale S. And this is true also for what I told you today. Arcs and moments don't just apply in effective field theories. They find just a beautiful application there, but they are more general. And it would be nice to understand better this, synergy. For me, it's all. And thanks a lot for the... for listening and the questions, and please ask more.
All right, thanks a lot for this nice talk. Yeah, I think we can go over to questions. We already had a few, so I would say if somebody has questions, just speak up. Maybe I'll just start with a quick question, because I just got a bit confused sort of towards the end when you talked about the loop effects. So do the loop effects affect the claim that only the first few coefficients can dominate or not?
Again, I left the door open for that. Very good. So basically, you can somehow see this in this plot. I mean, perhaps you got more familiar now already with this plot, I hope, by the end of the talk. And remember that this idea that the coefficients were monotonically decreasing was related to this upper, the bounds up here, right? So in fact, in the region to the right of this, C4 is bigger than C6. And in a region to the left of this, C2 is bigger than C4. So you see that the loop effects actually make this bound actually stronger. So the idea that super softness doesn't exist is still a fact, also at loop level, because the bounds got a little bit stronger, right? The bounds that failed are the ones that implied, for instance, positivity of C6, or that are related with the belly of this shape, so not with this idea of super softness.
Okay. Yeah, just to follow on this. So the region below one on the right plot, this is sort of like the lower belly on the left plot, is then?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, sorry. Basically this belly here is the dashed line here. And this region that excesses below the belly is this region here. That's why I changed coordinates, because here it was hard to convince you that there was an effect, while here it's a bit easier.